I'm Paul Kennedy. Welcome to the Enright Files on Ideas. Each month, Michael Enright, the host of the Sunday edition on CBC Radio 1, appears on Ideas with conversations on a particular theme. Here's Michael Enright.
Regular listeners to the Sunday edition will know that music is one of the pillars of our show, particularly classical music and jazz. But two of our most popular music pieces in recent years feature two of the most prolific singer-songwriters working in the American roots tradition. Veterans with scores of records and thousands of songs between them. Their careers span the decades, and their fans span the generations. But they seemingly have little in common. One was born and raised in poverty, but became a pop culture superstar. The other has lived defiantly outside the mainstream and became a dogged champion of the marginalized. One is Dolly Parton, and the other is Steve Earle, names that conjure up very different images and sounds, but whose songwriting is rich with storytelling, unforgettable characters, and snapshots of the American experience. This month on the Enright Files, how artists as different as Steve Earle and Dolly Parton capture the essence of American roots music and speak to the cultural and political currents of the past few decades in the U.S. We begin with Steve Earle. Steve Earle was 31 when he released his debut album, Guitar Town. That was in 1986. He had kicked around Nashville and the Texas music scene for more than a decade. His career stuck in neutral. MCA Records reluctantly released Guitar Town and was shocked to see it become a hit, commercially and critically. It was a bracing blast of twang and grit, honest, raw, and totally out of step with the slick, countrified pop music that dominated the country charts. Guitar Town was a founding document of what some called alternative country and what many others still call Americana music, rough-hewn music that revered pioneers of country, folk, bluegrass, and country rock. It also rejected the more suburban, conservative values that defined contemporary popular country music. The past three decades have seen Steve Earle record 18 albums, slide into the abyss of heroin addiction, homelessness, and prison, and become revered and reviled as an activist who takes up unpopular causes, and who shows compassion for the marginalized, the unloved, and the unredeemable, whether they be confessed murderers on death row or Americans who joined the Taliban. Steve Earle visited the Sunday edition in October of 2016 when he was in Toronto as part of a tour called Lampedusa, Concerts for Refugees. Here's our conversation.
All of us are post-Bob Dylan songwriters, and I think it's, you know, I woke up yesterday feeling legitimized because Bob Dylan, you know, won the Nobel Prize. And that means that what I do is literature, and I believe that all along. And there's a difference between the way I write songs and, you know, and it's nothing wrong with people that aren't writing songs at the level of literature, but Bob Dylan kind of invented that. The two most overused words in the English language are awesome and genius. Genius does not mean somebody that's really smart.
Yeah.
A genius is someone that does something at a level that it becomes something that's never existed in the world before. That's literally what the word means. And so Bob Dylan is a genius. And, you know, Charlie Parker was a genius. And Jimi Hendrix was a genius. The Beatles collectively were geniuses, but maybe not individually. Yeah. You know, it's a relatively rare thing.
When you were growing up in Texas, were your friends all writing music, or were they into folk music? You said at one point that they used to beat you up quite a lot.
Well, no, not my friends, but one of my friends beat me up once, but I kind of deserved it. You know, it was a very polarized social thing that there were kids that wore cowboy clothes and listened to country music largely, and they usually listened to some rock and roll, but they kind of did it secretly. And then there were other kids that dressed like what they saw on American Bandstand. And, you know, I was part of the latter group, except I always wore cowboy boots. And I not only got my hair cut with a pocket knife a couple of times, I got my boots stolen several times because I was considered to not be worthy of them. But then Willie Nelson moved back to Texas. And I found myself standing out in a pasture with the guys that used to kick my ass watching the same bands. And for a while there, when I left Texas in 1974, no one could imagine a Republican governor in Texas until a very short time ago.
It was LBJ country.
Yeah, and LBJ was, you know, the Democratic Party was the party of segregation originally, and Lyndon Johnson single-handedly changed that. He just decided it was the right thing to do. Kennedy had started it, but Kennedy didn't have the chops that LBJ did as a legislator. I don't think that JFK could have ever finished what he started.
Voting rights, civil rights acts.
Those big acts, you know, not just pay it lip service. Lyndon Johnson decided to make it his legacy, and he did it. And then Vietnam robbed him of that. And it's a shame. It really is.
I want to talk about Guy Clark, amazing singer, the Randall Knife, the Cape, Dublin Blues. What impact did he have on you and on your music?
Well, it starts with Towns for both of us.
Towns Van Zandt.
They were best friends. But by the time I got to Houston, Guy had already gone to the West Coast and then to Nashville. I'd heard Guy Clark songs because Jerry Jeff Walker had recorded them, a few people did, and I knew he was part of the Houston folk scene that I'd sort of stumbled in on the end of. Towns was still around, but he didn't really live anywhere. He would pass through. You know, he would be in Houston for a while, he'd be in Colorado for a while, and he'd be in Nashville for a while. And he literally didn't live anywhere for 8 years.
Towns Van Zandt, you met him when you were 17?
17
or 18. Yeah. Tell me just briefly about your relationship with him, because it seems that he inspired you and frustrated you in equal measure.
He did that with everybody. I mean, and the way Towns taught and the way Guy taught were completely... Guy would show you exactly how he went about writing songs. It wasn't necessarily the way you were supposed to do it. And some he had his opinions about that, and they changed over the years. I can remember him offering me a completely unused thesaurus one time in a rhyme dictionary, and I could tell he had never used them, and it was a test. If I'd taken them, I'd have been written off. But at the end of his life, he used both, you know, and I use both now. But Towns was more like... He'd tell you, always put the cap back on the bottle, somebody might kick it over. And he'd give you a copy of Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee and tell you to go read it. And in my case, he gave me Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee. Then he said, and read this while you're at it, and handed me War and Peace. So, you know, I returned books, so unlike some people. But I was living in San Miguel Allende, and I was camping out. Towns was living in the cabin that I had lived in before that I'd kind of turned over to him when I moved to Mexico. But I was in Nashville checking the traps. Something happened that I couldn't go back to Mexico. It probably had to do with money, or I was waiting on something. So I hung out, and I was camped at this watercress spring below the cabin. And, you know, he gave me those two books. And during that time, while I was waiting for the check or whatever I was waiting for, I read both those books. When it came time to go back to Mexico, I walked up to the cabin. I gave him Towns. I said, hey, here's your books. And, man, Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee. Thanks for making me read that. Yeah. Man, it blew my mind. He said, cool. What about War and Peace? I said, well, that was a little, you know, tougher slog. But, you know, I want to thank you for that, too, because I've got an eighth grade education. Him, you know, that was he did me a service. And then he keeps asking questions. And I realize after about 30 minutes, Towns had never read War and Peace. He just thought that I should. So Towns was brilliant and incredibly well read. All he did was read.
He had a sad life, didn't he?
Well, you know, Towns was an alcoholic. He also had a pretty deep, from the beginning, mental illness that he was probably bipolar. He was definitely hebephrenic, which means that when he got any amount of alcohol in his system at all, his behavior would change. It was often childish and often dangerous. I watched him play Russian roulette, you know.
You were in the room with him.
I was just me and
him. He's twirling the cylinder?
It's in a couple of books that people's opinions of why it happened. But the only person that's alive that was there is me. And when I finally got the gun from him, which was actually after he'd pulled the trigger twice, I beat his ass. I was just really, really angry.
Graham Greene did that once. He said when he was young. He played Russian roulette.
Really? How did I not know that about Graham Greene? I had my Graham Greene period was deep. There's a handful of people that I've read every single thing attributed to him. Ernest Hemingway's one, Graham Greene's one, William Shakespeare. I'm an Oxfordian. I have to cop to that. But reading Hemingway and Graham Greene one right after the other is something I suggest everybody do in their 20s, because they really were rivals. They really did not care for each other, and they both thought the other one was completely wrong about writing, but they both wrote great books. I think Graham Greene's output is arguably way more solid because he wasn't an alcoholic and the work didn't deteriorate. It's the same thing with Allen Ginsberg and the rest of the Beats. You know, it's Allen Ginsberg stands alone because he worked his whole life and he left a body of work.
You and Allen Ginsberg could have been separated at birth. You know?
Yeah, people have told me that. I've got a whole routine I do on stage about how men, you know, don't need skinny mirrors. And when I look in the mirror, I see the guy that was 20, unless I catch myself out of the corner of my eye. And then I think I've either seen my father's ghost or who the hell had Allen Ginsberg in here. But the truth is, I would have been honored to have ever had Allen Ginsberg in my apartment.
Define for me, if you can, the phrase outlaw country. Because it means different things to different people, I guess.
Yeah, and see, I think like rockabilly, the term outlaw country is something that was a coin that wasn't turned by the people that were actually playing the music. The best way to define it was the stuff that was recorded in the 70s where country artists, who were definitely country artists, their roots were in country music, but they were hearing other stuff too, and they wanted the creative freedom that rock bands had, and they'd never been afforded that. Rock artists were moving into studios for a month or 2 months or 3 months and making a record. Country artists were still doing 10 in the morning till 10 o'clock at night sessions, and everything had to be recorded in the studio owned by the label. In fact, Waylon was the very first person to record in an independent studio as he became a bigger star and got that power. Probably the first, in a lot of ways, Hank Williams qualifies because he was a singer-songwriter, and the town's always been kind of anti-singer-songwriter. But I don't think he meant to be that. He was trying to be as successful as he was also an alcoholic. So that's the deal. I'd have been an alcoholic and an addict if I'd been a carpenter. You know, it doesn't really have that much to do with the business. But this job that I do, I'm part of the literary part of the outlaw movement. That's who I really
am. Your songs are short stories, aren't they?
Well, yeah. That's the thing. I learned that from Guy Clark. What's harder for me is writing stuff that's more emotional and more poetic, like Mile from the Blues or God is God. Those are the things I end up being more proud of, because the stuff that's like Tom Ames Prayer and Copperhead Road, that comes pretty easily to me. I don't know why, but it does.
But you do have something in common. I mean, Johnny Cash and Merle Haggard and so on. And that seems to be an empathy for people on the margins. People who get into trouble, people on death row, the homeless, the hopeless.
Yeah, well, it's about, why did I write John Walker's Blues? Because nobody else was going to write that
song. This is the American boy who went over, fought for the Taliban.
Yeah, and I did it because I've got a 20-year-old boy who was 20 at the time. Justin and John Walker Lind are exactly the same age, which means John Walker Lind's 35 and he's still in prison.
Still in jail. I want to talk about your involvement with the death penalty.
Right.
I read a thing the other night you wrote for Tikkun magazine. It's about the execution of a friend of yours in Texas, Jonathan Nobles.
Yeah, friend is probably... No, he was a friend. He became a friend. I just think it's important to... It wasn't somebody that I knew that ended up on death row. It was a guy that I knew because I opposed the death penalty, and guys used to write me. And whether they were on death row or not, I would return a letter to anyone that wrote me from a jail anywhere. So
now, he wasn't innocent. He killed two people.
He killed two women and scarred, and the boyfriend of one of the women lost an eye in the attack and was almost killed himself. He was an escalating sexual killer that just got caught the first time, and he was a meth addict. That was part of it. He was raised in foster care. He had all of the things that mitigators will bring up in court. He could tick all the boxes. I mean, this is not making an excuse for him, but he never, ever claimed to be innocent. He just changed while he was in jail.
He had a conversion, became a Catholic.
He became a Dominican lay preacher.
Yeah.
And he was cremated in a Dominican habit. And
was he buried in Ireland? Because
his ashes were buried in England.
In England.
Because there was a woman, another pen pal of his, that had described this meadow. And, well, I can't say exactly where because it's not exactly legally buried. But it was near where she lived in England. And I took him to England and he's buried there.
It's very hard to read the last four or five paragraphs about the actual execution. You're in the room as a witness.
Not in the room. I mean,
well, you weren't in the room
glass,
where he was.
There's glass, but
it's like a radio studio.
I'm as close to him as you are to me.
Why did you want to be there?
Because I didn't want to be there. I was asked to be there, and I didn't know how to say no to a dying man's last request. I had 11 guys on death row. They're all gone now. They've all been executed. And none of my guys were innocent. I guess innocent people just don't write me. It's not one of those things. I don't know why that is.
Is your country going to get over this fetish about capital punishment?
It's dying of natural causes just like it did before. It's just taking the time it's taken. And the problem is when states like Texas, Virginia, and Florida start executing people, the ones that execute the most people are going to fight it the hardest because they'll have to atone at that point. But you do something and you convince that it's right, and then you find out that you're wrong, it's hard to stop doing it because that is in itself an admission that you were wrong. And this is not wrong like, oops, this is like wrong like people died.
You wrote an incredible song called Billy Austin about a young man, 29 years old, with a gun, shoots somebody, kills him, winds up on death row. If things had come together in a different way, could you have been Billy Austin?
No, I don't think so. For one thing, I'm a real live at a core level pacifist. I never liked to fight. I ended up doing it because I had to defend myself. But I had friends that could have. It's probably a stretch to say it's impossible because maybe anybody can become that if enough bad things happen to them.
The first time I saw you actually was in The Wire. You played your character, Wallen, was helping people through the 12-step program, trying to beat addiction. You've had your own struggles with heroin, alcohol.
Well, that required no acting. I played a redneck recovering addict.
When you went into rehab, you went into jail, then you were in rehab. What did that experience do for you? It changed you. It must have changed you.
Yeah, I didn't go to treatment to get clean. I went to get out of an orange suit. And I thought the food was going to be better, but I was wrong about that. But something happened. I did have, and this is a lot of what my book that I'm working on now is about. It's called I Can't Remember If We Said Goodbye. And the first part's about towns and my uncle and some other mentors who were for good and bad. The middle part's about the street and jail. And the third part is about recovery, largely. And I saw a film about Bill Wilson with James Woods and James Garner called My Name is Bill W. And it suddenly occurred to me.
Founder of AA.
Yeah. It suddenly occurred to me who those guys sleeping on my grandfather's couch were. And that connected me to it. I grew up with the steps and the serenity prayer on the wall. And it was an incredible help that I kind of knew. I had evidence that this would work in my life, which is one reason that I probably avoided it like the plague for years.
Yeah.
Because this wasn't done yet.
I want to just touch on your activism. And I want to start, if we could play just a bit of Ellis Unit 1. Ellis Unit 1 is where people condemned or held.
In Texas, it was. They've since moved it to another unit, but Ellis 1 unit was where Jonathan Nobles was, and that's the place I visited.
It was the soundtrack for the film Dead Man Walking.
Well, I've seen them fight like lions, boys. I've seen them go like lambs. And I've helped to drag them when they could not stand. And I've heard their mamas crying when they heard that big door slam. And I've seen the victim's family holding hands. Last night I dreamed that I woke up with straps across my chest. And something cold and black pumped through my lungs. Even Jesus couldn't save me, though I know he did his best. But he don't live on Ellis Unit 1.
I get choked up when I hear that. That's Steve Earle, and that is Ellis Unit 1. Why did you take on capital punishment as an issue?
Well, a couple of things happened. I mean, I was always opposed to it. My father, when I was a kid, the first activism I ever witnessed was my father, who believed in the death penalty, I mean, in a sort of passive way. He just sort of always assumed that some people probably deserved, were bad enough that they deserved that. But there was a kid named Ralph Carl Powers in Texas, in San Antonio, where I grew up. And he and a carload of kids ran into another car of kids in the supermarket parking lot late at night. The kids in the other car was a kid named Dickie Renfro in that car, and they were from Alamo Heights. They were from a really affluent part of San Antonio. Ralph Powers and his buddies were from the South Side, and they didn't have anything except that car between them. And they got into a big fight, and it was Dickie Renfro that brought a gun, that was carrying a gun that night. But somehow Dickie Renfro got killed. And Ralph Powers, it's possible that he didn't do it. Somebody else in the car did. It's possible that Dickie Renfro shot himself. Nobody ever really knew. But what happened was, it was legal in Texas at the time. If you had the means and you had a loved one that had been a violent crime had been committed against them, you could hire a special prosecutor and save the state the money. You could bring in a private lawyer. Absolutely. And they brought in a guy that was normally a defense attorney. His name was Fred Saman. He was the best criminal attorney in San Antonio, and they paid him a lot of money, and he prosecuted the case, and Ralph Carpowers was sentenced to death. A lot of people wrote a lot of letters, and my dad wrote this letter because he just didn't think it was fair that the special prosecutor was used. So he wrote a letter to the governor, the only letter like that I think he ever wrote in his life. He was an air traffic controller, had a government job, didn't really like to rock the boat all that much. But he did that, and as it was, the death penalty went away in the states, and so everyone on death row got their sentences commuted to life, and Ralph Powers died in prison after having his sentence commuted.
A couple of weeks ago, there was the 50th anniversary in San Antonio of the tower shooting.
Right. Well, that's Austin, actually.
Yeah. People in the crowd, because Texas has an open carry law, are carrying guns.
Yeah.
Nothing is going to change about guns in your country, is it?
No. And
they can kill 21 kids in Newtown, man.
Well, yeah, I know. But the deal is, never change. Look,
Never's a long time.
I've been to Belfast when there was gun trucks in the street, and they said that would never change. I don't believe that what's going on in the Mideast is hopeless. I don't believe in I'm a recovering heroin addict. I simply can't afford to believe in anything like a lost cause or a hopeless case. I used to be one of those people. I had guns. I grew up hunting and fishing. I thought that amendment meant something, and I thought it was something I had a right to do. I thought I was more responsible.
You remember the NRA?
I was, because I was a Boy Scout. Everybody that was ever a Boy Scout was a member of the NRA. Then I had about a year and a half clean, just getting going, and I was handed, an out-of-control 14-year-old boy. And Justin, the first thing he did when he got in my house is he found my pistol that I kept loaded under my bed, and he hid it, and he wouldn't tell me where it
really
was. And I didn't know what to do. So I packed him up. I searched him, made sure he didn't have it on him, and I drove him to a wilderness camp, they call it, and dropped him off and wrote a check just to make sure he was where the gun wasn't. It was January, and they were sleeping in tents, so he called me the next morning about 3:30, told me where the gun was. But it was one of those things. It's like, you're not doing your best parenting at 4.5 months clean. So I have not had a gun in my house since. And the truth is this. Most people, and I've seen enough situations involving guns, I think that I can say this. Most people are incapable of pulling the trigger when they're pointing it at another human being. That's what all that training in the Army is about, is to get you where you could do that.
Yeah.
It can happen by accident, the way guns are designed, really easily, and that a lot of tragedies occur that way. But we're supposed to be that way. We're supposed to be unwilling to kill.
You're a Southerner. Did you get a lot of flack with Mississippi It's Time?
I got the kind of flack you get. I got, you know, I've seen some scary things. I'm not scared of emails. You know, that's not the way you're going to intimidate me.
But the Mississippi, I mean, it reminded me of Phil Oaks, of Nina Simone.
Right.
You know,
I quote Nina Simone in it.
Is the South changed?
Yes and no. I mean, certain things haven't changed. It's not just the South, though. Boston's one of the most racially polarized places I've ever been in my life. You know, I don't quote Condoleezza Rice often, but she says something I think is really profound, that my country suffers from a birth defect, and that birth defect is slavery. And we were created as a last place for the second and third sons of landed European families to make their fortunes, with the practice of slavery 50 years after it had been outlawed every place else. And we still treat people that are different than us that way when it gets right down to it.
For foreigners, for Canadians looking south, what is going on in your country?
Boy, you're talking about the election?
Yeah.
Well, if you have any doubts that reality television is toxic, that's what you're seeing now. It's an erosion of culture that wasn't necessarily that structurally sound to begin with. A democracy that's sort of non-parliamentary democracies are problematic. That, you know, when you have no meaningful system of where any political party can hold a seat and therefore have an effect, that we're practicing a less pure form of democracy than most countries in the world are.
But it's a democracy that's thrown up a person like Donald Trump.
That's the cultural part of it. If you start believing that reality television's real,
yeah,
and that Fox is news, then these things can happen. So, you know, I don't watch reality television. I used to hang upside down in an inversion table and smoke crack and watch Cops for a while in the very early 90s. But that's my only experience with reality television. But I'm trying to protect my intellect. But some of it's solidarity with friends of mine who are actors. It's really kind of cut down on the jobs for actors in Hollywood and in New York. But it's bad for you. It's just appealing to our lowest common denominator. Everybody is capable of being fascinated with violence. Everybody's capable of being overly fascinated with sex on a just strictly salacious level. We're all human. We're all capable of that. And the only way you protect yourself from it is to read a book, go see a play, go, you know, and we make that stuff. It takes a lot of money to see a play in my culture. Whereas in Ireland, you know, every play that plays the Abbey tours the country at popular price tickets. And you know, you have poetry by Seamus Heaney in the In-Flight magazine of the National, you know, you realize that you're in a different culture than the one that I grew up in.
I can't let you go without talking about refugees. See, why did you get involved with that?
One of the ugliest parts of this election cycle in the States, and it's not just happening in the States. I saw it happening in Britain in a big way in politics. And you've corrected your political situation to some degree in this country since, you know, my last tour here. So maybe things will be better here. Because Canada's actually done an exemplary job of taking in refugees compared to other countries of its population.
U.S. is taking in 10,000. We've taken in 35,000.
35,000. Yeah. And your population is one-tenth. I know that because I have platinum records here and I don't have them in the United States. So I know what the math is. So all of these countries on this continent, the populations are all immigrant, you know, populations. Sure. A frightening high percentage of those people were originally refugees. They were leaving a place they couldn't stay anymore. There are refugees in camps all over the world. There are refugees in Africa. There are refugees in the Middle East. Lampedusa is the name of an island off the coast of Sicily. That's the name of these countries that a lot of people have ended up on coming out of the Middle East. So we took it as the name of this concert tour. It's one of those things when politicians want to use people who have had to leave their homes because they have to, and they want to scare us into thinking that there's a threat to us by taking those people. And the threat, in the way I look at it, is these people are mostly young people. The vast majority of them are children and teenagers and people in their 20s, and they're going to become something based on their experience. That's how that works and how we treat them and whether we help them. That's how you create terrorists and how you create a threat.
That was my interview with the great singer-songwriter Steve Earle. It originally aired on the Sunday edition in October 2016.
This is Ideas on CBC Radio 1 and Sirius XM. I'm Paul Kennedy. Tonight, the Enright Files with Michael Enright.
At first glance, Dolly Parton would seem to be the antithesis of Steve Earle. If Earle is a scruffy critic of the American mainstream, Dolly Parton is an icon of the country music establishment and all its glitz, rhinestones, and big hair. The backwoods Barbie, as she styles herself, and she's a megastar. She's worth $500 million with more than 40 albums and 4,000 songs to her credit, not to mention a theme park. And yet, she has cultural cachet well beyond the big concert halls of Nashville. 4 years ago, she headlined the Glastonbury Music Festival in England, one of the most influential rock, pop, and alternative music festivals in the world. and one attended primarily by teens and 20-somethings. During her set, the 68-year-old woman on stage in a white pantsuit sang songs extolling the traditional country music values of family, God, and simple pastoral pleasures. And she had complete command over thousands of young theatergoers liberally decorated with tattoos and piercings. I had to confess I was baffled by Dolly Parton's appeal, particularly to such a young generation that would seem to have little in common with her values, aesthetics, and life story. So we asked our house music expert, Robert Harris, to explain the Dolly Parton phenomenon to us. Here is our conversation from October 2014.
I do not know very much about Dolly Parton. I saw her in a movie called 9 to 5.
Very good.
I don't think I've ever knowingly heard her music, but I'm sorry, I do not know anything about her.
Excellent. So I've got three little snippets to help you understand the phenomenon of Dolly Parton, because, you know, all successful performers, and she more than most, it's built on disguise. You know, hiding in plain sight is basically what many, many performers do for us, and that's exactly what Dolly Parton does. So we're going to keep our mics on. We're trying to guess what we're listening to, okay? So take a listen to this for starters.
Když se kouknu kurám v dáli, v duši mám ten stín, ten, co zazněl v Lubošovo Markovo
huslí.
Czech.
Czech.
We are in Prague, the summer of 2010, in an open-air concert that 40,000 people are.
40,000 people.
Kam se to nestrácí, bez čubok s námi hrá.
And we're listening to bluegrass music in Czechoslovakia.
And that's Dolly Parton.
You'll see in a second that, in fact, hiding behind these Czech performers...
Oh, these are... yeah, okay.
...is a Dolly Parton song. You'll hear Dolly in a second. It's called My Tennessee Mountain Home. They're 10,000 miles from Tennessee. Here's Dolly.
Their fragrance makes the summer wind so sweet. And on a distant hilltop, an eagle spreads its wings. And a songbird on a fence post sings a melody.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's in Prague.
That's in Prague.
Yeah.
So here's the first thing you need to know about Dolly Parton, is okay, that her influence is worldwide. And it's not just her influence, it's the influence of country music. As I say, these people are 10,000 miles. They've never seen the Smoky Mountains. They've never been to Sevier County, Tennessee. And they lovingly reproduce this song of Dolly Parton's. So that's number one.
Okay.
Dolly Parton in
Czech. Prague.
So here's number two. See if you can identify this one.
If I should stay, I would only be
any idea?
Your way.
If you knew it, you would know by now. No. So you saw 9 to 5, but you didn't see the movie The Bodyguard with Whitney Houston and Kevin Costner.
Oh, yes, I did.
But I,
this is the fifth greatest hit in all of popular music history, called I Will Love You, that Whitney Houston sang at the end.
Yes, yes.
The way
Whitney Houston sang it. But Dolly Parton wrote it.
Dolly Parton wrote it?
Take a listen.
And will always love you.
I didn't know that.
It's surprising the number of people who don't know that. Dolly Parton, among other things, which this proves, is a great songwriter. Now, we know Dolly Parton as a performer, and we know the image of Dolly Parton, but what Dolly Parton really is, in her essence, is a songwriter, and a great songwriter. David Foster produced it.
Yeah.
Dolly Parton wrote it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's excerpt number two.
Okay.
Here's excerpt number three. This is a song, another Dolly Parton song, a great country hit of hers called Jolene. that's actually sung in this case not by her, but by Miley Cyrus, of all people, who is in fact Dolly's goddaughter. And it's a great version, but I'm playing it so you'll hear something else. So here's Miley Cyrus and Dolly Parton's Jolene. Now, this is Dolly in Glastonbury this summer, 100,000 people, 50 years younger than she is, every single one of them. Take a listen.
Now, how many of you go so far back that you'd remember a song of mine called Jolene?
Wow. They're singing along.
100,000 people are singing along.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it is amazing. She was the hit of the festival.
That's incredible.
In years past, I would have called her an old woman. Now, yeah, she's a youngster, but, you know, she's 68. She'll be 69 in January. She's been working for 50 years, and they loved her. And they knew all the words to a song that's from the 70s. And as I say, these kids are in 18 and 19 and 20. So that's the third thing.
They're her grandchildren.
Basically. Yeah. And she put on a great show for them. So that's the next thing you need to know about Dolly Parton. She's an extraordinary performer. There's something about this woman. Part of it is on the surface. Most of it is not. Like her songwriting ability. If you're a country music fan, you know that Dolly Parton, 4,000 songs this woman has written. 4,000. And most of her great hits are her own songs. And, you know, a songwriter's mentality and a performer's mentality are quite different. And you add into that, she's an incredibly intelligent woman. Oh, my, she's so smart. And an amazing businesswoman. She's worth $500 million. She's the richest country music star in the world. And so you get to the point where you realize that there's more to Dolly Parton than meets the eye. Then I want to start with how she looks, because how she looks is really, really important.
Why?
So the question is, is she real? Is it real? Is her body real? So here's the story of Dolly Parton's body, if I may say so. She's 4'11" tall. She's incredibly tiny. Like, she's tiny, right? And when she was well into her 30s, she was very heavy. She was, in fact, quite hefty. She calls herself a little fat girl.
Yeah.
And then around the time 9 to 5 hit and she moved from the country world into the mainstream, you know, whether she decided to or whether the pressures forced her, she lost an enormous amount of weight. So she got smaller everywhere. Okay. So she was big everywhere.
Yeah. Because,
and now she was small everywhere. And so what she did is she turned to plastic surgery to recover the dimensions of her upper half that she had had when she was a heavier woman. And, you know, that's unbelievably important because she has artificially created something that was real in the first place. And that's country music. You ask what country music is? Country music is a music that sells authenticity. Now, those are contradictions, because if you're authentic, you're spontaneous. And if you're selling something, you're trying to manipulate me. So country music is this extraordinarily subtle and very complicated musical form that trades in nostalgia and the good old days and family values.
All right. This past summer, I listened again to that incredible series you did about the history of the recording industry.
Right.
And you talk about the Carter family.
Yep.
When the guys from New York went down into the hill country of Appalachia and all that, and the Smokies, and found these people. Authenticity was the key there. Now, is Dolly Parton a descendant of that tradition,
or is
she authentic?
So is Dolly Parton part of that tradition? Yes.
Okay.
Is she authentic? So here's the question. What is authentic? What do we think this word means?
I don't know.
Yeah. Well, you see, we don't know.
Yeah.
And so Dolly Parton's an interesting woman because she's older. So she was born in 1946. So when she talks about her upbringing in poverty, which she does, it's real. But in today's country artists, you know, the Taylor Swifts and the Miley Cyruses, you know, they were born in the 80s. You know, Garth
Brooks. Well, I knew the name. See?
Yeah, but he has a university degree. So the question is, what does real mean in this? What is authentic? And I don't have an answer to that, but I'll tell you why it's important, because it has impact much broader than music. It has a political impact as well. And it has a political impact because that country world, basically the world of the South, dominates American politics today. The last few presidents, basically presidents since Jimmy Carter until Barack Obama, have all come from the South or the Southwest. The Tea Party and everything it represents is a Southern phenomenon. I mean, and it's exactly the same set of values. So the question you ask about, is Dolly Parton real? Is the question I would ask, is Sarah Palin real? Is Michelle Bachman real? Is Rand Paul real? These values of America, you know, how real are they? How manipulated are they? So country music plays with these.
It reflects them or creates them?
It's both. You see, this is the question. So those people in Czechoslovakia singing about my Tennessee mountain home, yeah, who have never been there, were nostalgic for something they never experienced in the first place, you know? The values of country music are these values of home and
God,
family and God. And the question you ask about how real is it, I would ask about those values. Like, how real is it? You know, because we do know, you know, without pointing figures, that all of these family values guys are always the guys that we find, you know, propositioning their pages. And so the question of, is with Dolly Parton real, is a much bigger political question. It's the question is, are any of those values real? Because if none of them are real, we're in trouble, you know? And yeah, so I would say that, in fact, one of the political divides in the United States, and starting to become a political divide in this country as well, is how real are those values? And so listening to Dolly Parton is really important.
Okay.
Now, for me, she does fall on the side of authenticity. And I think what it means is that she has remained true to those values that she grew up with. And it is part of those values of the Carter family and Jimmy Rogers, because those values of country and of home, they do have a meaning.
Sure.
They
yep.
can
yep.
have a meaning.
We make fun of them, we in the East, the yes. urbanites and all that.
So Dolly Parton is real, and it's important that she come across as real, because as I say, intentionally or not, she stands for a political movement. I'm not talking about her political views.
Not but partisan. Fact,
not partisan in any way, but those values are so important to the American psyche. If they're found to be fraudulent, if they're found to be hollow, that's a really significant problem for a lot of people. But that's not the only thing that's important about Dolly Parton. I mean, what's most interesting to me about Dolly Parton is the fact that she's an icon of feminism. You know?
Okay, now I knew we were going to talk about this, and I must say I was taken aback.
Well, you know, it's interesting because, you know, you would say that this is a woman who basically has fashioned herself to be a combination of Daisy May from Little Abner and Stupefying Jones from Little Abner, right? So she's, you know, dolled up and, you know, the backwoods Barbie. She has disguised herself in plain sight as exactly the stereotype that we expect her to be. And therefore can hide away and do the work that she wants to do because we're so convinced that that big hair, you know.
Hick. She's a hick.
Exactly. You know. She's, in fact, one up on us. She has, in fact, created this wonderful hiding place in plain sight. Dolly Parton is performing a role for us. She's playing herself.
Yeah.
She's playing a version of herself that allows her to go about her business. So many women that I know instantly understand that. I got to remember, Dolly Parton is 68 years old.
Yeah.
So she grew up at a time when she couldn't just be who she is. She had to hide. And so she's hidden that way. So, you know, it's interesting because Nashville, the country music place, which is a very sexist, very, you know, misogynist place, sort of recognized that.
She started out in Nashville.
She did. So I want you to listen to a song called Dumb Blonde, not written by her, but written for her, specifically for her. And it's, again, it's Dolly Parton hiding in plain sight. Take a listen.
And here's a little gal that I know you're going to really learn to love, because she's a fine singer and one of the finest little gals that I've ever met. Let's give her a great big welcome as she sings a song that she had a big hit on called Dumb Blonde. She ain't no dumb blonde, though. Pretty Miss Dolly Parton. How about it?
Just because I'm blonde, don't think I'm dumb, 'cause this dumb blonde Just because I'm blonde, don't think I'm dumb, 'cause this dumb blonde ain't nobody's fool.
That's from 1967. That's Dolly Parton in Nashville, Tennessee, with one of her first hits called Dumb Blonde.
Yeah, I think Dolly has written an autobiography, but if she's going to write another one, This Dumb Blonde is Nobody's Fool is what it should be called. So you asked about her career. What you heard was, in fact, her first appearance on a syndicated television program called The Porter Wagner Show.
Porter Wagner.
Okay, fine. So Porter,
Grand Ole Opry and all that.
45 million people watch this show, and Dolly starts. So Dolly's career is the day after she graduated from high school, 1966, she graduated Friday night. She was in Nashville Saturday morning.
Really?
Yeah, because her father wouldn't let her go before then.
Yeah.
And she started her career as a songwriter. She started trying to sell songs, because that's what she is a songwriter. And eventually she sold a few, and eventually she recorded a few. And Porter Wagner had a girl singer, was leaving, and he hired Dolly. And this was her first big break. For most people, this was the first time they'd ever actually heard the name Dolly Parton. Yeah. It was what you just heard. That was the first song she ever sang on Porter Wagner's show. And what's really interesting is the history of this. So they signed a 5-year deal. She stayed for 7 years. They had many, many hits together. And eventually Dolly said to herself, I don't want to be a girl singer. I want to be a star. And so she went to Porter Wagner and she said, I said I'd give you 5 years. I've given you seven. So, I'm leaving.
Goodbye.
And he freaked out. And they had this horrible, you know, not quite public, but sort of semi-public fight about whether she would leave. And he wouldn't allow her. I mean, he had no legal hold over her. But, you know, he was her mentor. And finally, in frustration, the one thing she could do is write a song. So she showed up at his house one Saturday morning with a song that she had written to try and explain to him how she felt about their relationship.
Come on.
I'm not kidding. That song, we actually heard it. I Will Always Love You, that Whitney Houston song.
Really?
Take a listen. This is the way it sounded on Porter Wagner's show.
It's time for a real beautiful ballad, and I think this is one of the most beautiful that Miss Dolly has written. I hope you'll enjoy it today. It's one titled, I Will Always Love You. Miss Dolly Parton.
Thank you,
Dolly Parton, I Will Always Love You, from 1974 on the Porter Wagner Show. I'm choking up.
It's an amazing story, isn't it? See, this is why people love Dolly Parton.
God, this is what?
Because she's a wonderful person.
Jeez.
She is an authentic person, you know? And of course, Porter Wagner, because this is the country music world, so when she played it for him, said, okay, I get it. I'll let you go on one condition. You let me produce the song so we can both make some money. So to me, to get back to the question that we want to I think really is critical with Dolly Parton. Yes, she's a wonderful person and she writes great songs, but that question of her authenticity is what I want to come back to. And I think it's real. I think that one of the reasons that Dolly works for so many different kinds of people, you know, and the reason that she could make that transition, because, you know, in 9 to 5, she was sort of playing herself, but there is a reality there that I think is incorrigible and people respond to it. 60 Minutes did a big takeout on Dolly 5 years ago when she was 63. And Morley Safer was the interview. And one of the things they did is they showed her she had a syndicated television show, and they showed her an excerpt from the show. Take a listen to what that sounded like.
Where'd you get that?
We surprised her with a tape she hadn't seen in 30 years.
Oh, that's Mama.
What have I done that makes you
creepy
so?
Hey, look at Daddy! Oh, my gosh. Oh, look at that little fat girl he's dancing with. Who's that?
He left with you, old man.
The tape ends with the old hymn, The Sweet By and By. Dolly sang it as a kid in the church of her grandfather, a country preacher. It's about a joyful family reunion in the hereafter.
We shall meet on that beautiful show.
Well, now, what am I going to do now? You can't get me back in line here. That's very touching to me because Mom and Daddy are both gone now. I haven't seen that in so long. We just pulled at my heart there.
Would you like a drink?
No, that's okay. Yeah, whiskey?
Yeah.
Yeah, some moonshine would be nice about now.
So this is the song that Dolly wrote about her mother, her most famous song in some ways.
Back through the years, I go wandering once again. Back to the seasons of my youth, I recall box of rags that someone gave us, and how my mama put the rags to use. There were rags of many colors, but every piece was small, and I didn't have a coat, and it was away down in the fall. Mama sewed the rags together, so in every piece we loved, she made my coat of many colors that I was so proud of.
Ms. Dolly Parton, her coat of many colors, and for many, her finest song.
Shania Twain's favorite song in the world, is that coat? Yeah, she's the real deal.
She's terrific.
Well, you know, this is the power of popular culture, if I may say so, is that when you do get these people who have a combination of talent and intelligence, you know, this woman is intelligent, you know, she's smart. And she provides us, as all artists do, classical or popular, an ability for us to express ourselves when we can't express ourselves. Yeah. And, you know, when it happens in popular culture, it's rarer because popular culture is tied up with commercialism. It's tied up with a lot of fake values. Yeah. But she shines through. She's an amazing woman.
Thank you, sir.
It's a pleasure.
A coat of many colors my mama made for me.
That was my conversation with Robert Harris about Dolly Parton. It originally aired on the Sunday edition in October 2014. And that's it for this edition of the Enright Files. Thank you for listening.
On Ideas, you heard The Enright Files, featuring the host of the Sunday edition, Michael Enright. To find out about upcoming Ideas programs, subscribe to our weekly newsletter. You'll find the link at our website, cbc.ca/ideas. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. The Enright Files is produced for Ideas by Chris Wadsku. The executive producer of Ideas is Greg Kelly, and I'm Paul Kennedy. The hourly news is next.